LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Courtney Brown, who joins us to discuss the Farsight Institute's latest project, Remote Viewing Cydonia Mars. The data collected during the project suggests that long ago, a civilization existed on Mars. This civilization built something in a place now known as Cydonia. Many on Earth speculated that it appeared to be a face looking upward, but it's something else. The Farsight project suggests that it was a place where people congregated and lived. A city of Martians who were more like us on Earth than most would imagine. Combining two of the most skilled remote viewers currently on the planet, using US military-derived methodologies for perceiving across time and space, and working within a scientifically clean and totally blind experimental design, the Farsight project describes how Martians lived and how they died. The science of remote viewing has matured to the extent that a project such as this has finally been achievable, but no one could have expected the results to be as shocking as what was finally revealed. And there are lessons here that our own civilization can learn, should we wish to avoid the terrible fate that befell the denizens of Mars. Hello and welcome, Courtney, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hey, Greg, it's my pleasure and my honor to be here, so thanks for inviting me.
Excellent. Well, Courtney, today we're going to talk about the Farsight Institute's latest remote viewing project, which has just been released. This is called Remote Viewing Cydonia Mars. Before we dive into that, as ever, tell listeners a little bit about yourself, about the Farsight Institute, and for people who don't know, just get them up to speed on what remote viewing is.
Sure. Well, I'm the leading scholar in the subject of remote viewing as it is done using procedures that were developed by the United States military and used for espionage purposes, or procedures that are derivative of those methodologies. So the U.S. military and the CIA paid for a project known as remote viewing. And remote viewing is a mental procedure. A lot of people think of it as psychic, but it goes way beyond that. There's a mental procedure that's used to allow trained individuals to perceive across time and space in complete violation to the known laws of physics, the fundamentals of physics. So, you know, we have new physics that help explain that now, but the stuff that you're taught in the university seems to prohibit that. So what we understand now is that the laws of physics that were taught at the university really work within a small subset of a larger reality, because now we know that this remote viewing allows us to explore beyond the limitations of just that. So for those of your listeners who are thinking that this type of thing is impossible, it's just that the laws of physics that were taught in the university are needing a new update, we might call it. Remember, the quantum mechanics and relativistic physics, which are basically the bottom line of what's taught at university levels worldwide, the fundamentals have not changed for 100 years, so they're 100 years old. The details are great. I'm a mathematician. I work in a social science program in a major university. I don't do any remote viewing research at the university, but nonetheless, I really appreciate the mathematics as a quantum mechanics, relativistic physics, but it's clear that it's limited to a subset of a sort of a larger reality. And where you are seeing a change in physics that allows the understanding of how remote viewing works, but it hasn't really hit the sort of the mainstream. About 18% of mainstream physicists now accept alternate views of physics, alternate views of of interpretations of the quantum mechanical understanding and its macro implications, but you still have about 82%. The 18% that do accept these alternate new ways of thinking about it really are younger, and the older ones were simply waiting for them to retire and die off, and that's a generational replacement, and that's normal. But the basic idea, it's a mental procedure where trained individuals can perceive across time and space to see things that they otherwise would be impossible to see. That means they can see things in the past, present, or the future, or something on the other side of the planet, under what's called totally blind conditions, meaning they're not told, go remote view the Eiffel Tower. They're told there is a target, remote view it. That's all they're told. They go into a room, specially designed room, doesn't have a lot of sensory distractions in it, and they sit down an hour and a half later, come out with complete descriptions of what that thing is that they were supposed to describe, which can be, it's called a target, it can be people, places, whatever. And so we at the Farsight Institute, F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T, like seeing far, we're the leading civilian group that, hey, we're actually the only show in town in terms of a major venue for huge scientific studies and remote viewing. And we also have a lot of projects that we have done that are very interesting. Most of our stuff is totally for free. It's on our website, www.farsight, that's farsight.org, including complete instructional information on the remote viewing, on remote viewing procedures. There's many different styles of remote viewing. The big ones are CRV, controlled remote viewing, and the Hawaii Remote Viewing Guild procedures. Now, both of those are military-derived, but CRV came out of a project, an official project in the Defense Intelligence Agency, and HRVG came out of an unofficial movement within the military that was later known as the First Earth Battalion. And that was featured in the movie Men Who Stare at Goats, starring George Clooney and Jeff Bridges. So, you know, this is the existence, the capability of remote viewing is not in dispute among people who know anything about it, but it's still not at this point where it's taught at the university level. But that's okay. That will change in the not too distant future.
You mentioned initially this is being developed by the military, so a relatively mundane use of remote viewing might have been American remote viewers, military remote viewers, trying to suss out perhaps what a Russian base had.
You know, exactly.
They had maybe aerial photographs, but it wasn't clear, and they wanted more details on that. And you've, of course, taken this way beyond such mundane concerns, and you've done a number of projects in the past that are wild by comparison, and people will find links to all those on the interview page for this show. On this particular one we're talking about, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, Cydonia, Mars. Now, Cydonia is a region of Mars, and it's become quite well known amongst people interested in astronomy and just, you know, space aficionados generally, because for a long time, the early NASA photographs of this region appeared to show what looked like a face. And as the resolution of subsequent photographs has improved, it's turned out it's not really what it looks like at all. So what interested you about this particular region, and then outline what you noticed about it when you started to examine it in detail?
Yeah, going back to your military use of remote viewing with that base, the satellites can take a picture of something on the surface, but the remote viewers can describe everything that's in the satellite picture. So they can validate or verify everything that's in the picture, but they can also go into the base, something that the satellite cannot do, and they can walk around in the base and tell people what's there. Now, this you have to be really good to do this. This is not something that the casual person can do or even conceive of how to do, let alone that sort of the natural psychic you meet at a psychic fair. These types of things go way beyond anything like that. So this type of use of this mental procedure is, you know, your listeners should not think that it's a common experience. It's, in one sense, everyone has intuitions, but to refine it to the point where this type of thing can be done at military quality, that's completely different. Now, the official program closed in November of 1995. What is, and when it became public, and now I cannot tell you, you have to consider this hearsay because I cannot bring people to validate it and to actually say this is, you know, sort of to fess up and talk about it. But the military program now in remote viewing is way bigger, much bigger than it was back in November of 1995. I mean, they're doing some very interesting stuff. So I can't say, you know, talk to so-and-so and they'll tell you the whole thing. As soon as that becomes public, they'll close that one down and start up another one and say, oh, I don't know how that one started. That was the first one is, you know, it was just a rogue general slipped through the cracks. But, you know, they have an extreme interest in that type of stuff, but their stuff is military oriented. And our stuff at the Farsight Institute, we've had the military guys on our board of directors. So we have a lot of interaction with them. But the point is that our stuff is totally civilian. And when we look at things, we're not limited by things that can be rules that the military can say can or cannot be made public. We can try anything. So with regard to the Cydonia project that you just asked about, that was always an interest to me because I never thought there was a face on Mars. I mean, I saw the original Viking photographs, but, you know, who knows what that thing is. It was big. It was like 3 kilometers from corner to corner. So the idea that it was a Sphinx-like thing carved out of rock, 3 kilometers big, I mean, that's like, who would do that facing upwards? I mean, that's a lot of work to do something like that. So I sort of raised my eyebrows and said, well, I don't know about that. Then the better photographs came in, and NASA, which has a clear interest in dampening down discussion, public open discussion about extraterrestrial content, NASA published a lot of stuff saying, see, look at these new photographs. It's not a face. See, I told you so. And the mainstream media, which was essentially ignoring the face idea, chimed in immediately. So whenever the officialdom says something, the mainstream media is very quick to repeat it. Whenever somebody else comes up and says something that's opposite what the mainstream media or the officialdom is saying, the mainstream media sort of just ignores that. So, but the idea of it not being a face was really well publicized with these new photographs. And I looked at the new photographs, which were really high resolution, really nice. And I just chuckled over the whole thing because I wasn't even looking for a face. I mean, I thought the whole idea of a face was preposterous in the first place, just because who would do such a thing? But I saw in the photograph absolutely unambiguous, clear, parallel and perpendicular lines, a perimeter around this thing, and a semicircle on the other end. That was totally unnatural. I mean, nature with erosion processes simply does not make perfectly parallel and perpendicular lines as a perimeter around something and then a semicircle on the other side. It just never, ever, ever happens. And so I said, you know, this is like a magician's show where the magician distracts you by having something going on the left while he or she is doing something on the right. So this whole talk about the face was really distracting to everybody because if they said, okay, it's not a face, then they weren't seeing it. So easy to distract people. They weren't seeing what was right in front of their own faces, which was clear evidence of artificiality, at least on the surface level. So back in the old days, I always had it in my mind, hey, I'm going to investigate that one day if I ever get a chance. And as the chief investigator for many projects at the Farsight Institute, I was able to send these remote viewers. And we work with the absolute best remote viewers on the planet. These are like scary good remote viewers. Dick Allgaier, who's out in Hawaii, he studied the HRVG method, came out of Special Forces Intelligence with Glenn Wheaton out in Hawaii. And then Daz Smith, who's British, he's out in Bath. And he works with CRV, Controlled Remote Viewing, which is a method that came out of the Defense Intelligence Agency. So two different methodologies, two different viewers, opposite ends of the planet, totally blind. They were never told anything about what the nature of the project was. They were just given a non-leading email from me saying, we have a new project, we have a target, remote view it, do it. And they did it with no communication between themselves whatsoever. And they came in with totally corroborating data. Now, the data that they have for the Cydonia thing is very important to describe. There's two types. One is called verifiable and the other is new. Now, the verifiable data are data that match the target photo, the photo that was given to us by NASA, JPL, and University of Arizona partners. And that's very important because for remote viewing data to be worth anything, there has to be a huge element of verifiable data that is absolutely without dispute. And the remote viewers, under totally blind conditions, have to describe those data without any problems. Those data have to be a perfect match. And then, since they're at the target site with their perceptions, they then just go on, you know, they don't know what's verifiable or not at the time they're doing the sessions. They just go on and keep on describing whatever they see. And so they fill in the rest of the story. We get the entire backstory of what's actually there. And in the old days, the military use of remote viewing was always done with paper and pen. And Greg, it was dreadfully boring to watch. It's like watching the grass grow day after day. So what we did is we changed it. We said, hey, this is not something that's good. We started to do things with the remote viewers standing up in front of whiteboards using markers to do their sessions. So we have morphed out of the paper and pen process. Those are paper and pen sessions are used just as warm-up sessions to let remote viewers get sort of an initial feel of the target. Then we switch over to video. Now, it's hard for us to do this, so people should really appreciate how much effort goes into this. These things are done totally blind. That means the remote viewers don't have anybody anywhere near them that knows anything about the target. That means they set up their own camera. They set up their own audio. They're the audio guy. They're the camera guy. They set up their own whiteboard. And then we also do green screen stuff. So they set up their own green screen. And they do the focus themselves. The audio has to be perfect. There's a lot of stuff that has to go on. And then they turn on the camera and they start their sessions. So, the level of capability to do something like this is really, really high. So when you have a local person like Daz Smith in the UK, you have to understand you have a planetary resource there that, you know, other countries simply don't have. And it's an extraordinary thing. I don't think, one day I hope Britain wakes up to the idea that, you know, the UK and the United States have some remote viewers that are extraordinary, but it's very unusual. And having someone like Daz Smith is on the planet. I mean, look, you've ever, you know, the Queen of England. Well, this person's more rare than the Queen of England. I mean, this is a very rare person and he happens to be just right around the corner of you. And so, you know, Brits really need to understand that this is a very unusual thing and other countries would do anything to be able to have similarly trained people. There's a lot of people who are trained in remote viewing to a basic level. But to be at this level where you can describe things in such exquisite, elegant detail is just not something, it's not a casual level of training. It's like Lang Lang playing the piano. You can go up and play the piano and make noise, but if you want to hear Lang Lang play it in Carnegie Hall, I mean, that took a lot of work for Lang Lang to get to that level. And that's what we're talking about with people like Daz Smith and Dick Elgar. So anyway, that's what they do. And that's why I picked Cydonia, because of these parallel and perpendicular lines. Now, if you go to our website, farsight.org, www.farsight, like seeing far.org, and right at the top, you'll see a big banner for, you know, Cydonia Mars. Click on that. You can actually see the pictures that are in the target definitions, the things that the remote viewers were supposed to perceive. Again, they didn't see those target definitions when they were doing their sessions, but you can see the targets and you can clearly see the parallel and perpendicular lines. And you can chuckle along with me if you want with regard to the face idea, and how well that face discussion really distracted everyone from what's so obvious when you look at the picture and just forget the face idea, but then look at the picture for what it is and you say, oh my gosh, look at that. And those things, it's a huge thing, 3 kilometers from corner to corner. It's got a perimeter around it, and it's elevated. So what we did was we sent the viewers in it for 2 different time points, what it is right now, and they replicated exactly what it is. They gave everything that was in the target photo that NASA so graciously supplied. And then they went in and described everything. They found structures buried underneath the surface, saying these are hard for people to see. These are sort of embedded, tremendously weathered. Something very ancient in the past is here. And then they went back in time to the point when the Cydonia stuff was in maximum use, when it's in its prime condition, and saw what was going on there. And that's when we saw what the Martians looked like, what they were doing. They were just like us, Greg. Literally, they looked like us. They acted like us. The reviewers went into their religious issues, how they had charismatic leaders. That place that's in Cydonia is an elevated place, and in fact, it was surrounded by an ocean. And NASA now completely acknowledges there was huge oceans all over Mars. And that's actually a recent thing. Just a couple of weeks ago, they finally confessed that, which was that the oceans were, covering basically about half the planet, and that they lasted for millions and millions of years. It wasn't just like, in the past, NASA was saying, yeah, it looks like there was some water there, and it might have been around for a few thousand years before it evaporated off. So now they're saying that the planets were huge, they covered a huge swath of area on Mars, and that they lasted for, perhaps hundreds of millions of years, that's in the so-called habitable zone. So that's melted water, warm, go bathing, go swimming, that type of thing, for millions, hundreds and hundreds of millions of years. So they're slowly introducing the ideas to the public. Now NASA knows full well what's there. They know that there was a civilization there, the whole thing. But the acknowledgement that there was life on Mars and it was intelligent life on Mars, that has never been a scientific decision to make on whether to talk about it publicly. Everyone always says we have to wait for scientists to discover this. They're living in a Disney world. That's a dreamland world. It's never, ever, from the very beginning, been a scientific issue. It's a political issue. The political people have to make the decision that it's okay to say these things, that it's okay. This type of stuff is not handled on the scientific level. Scientists are the front men of a dog and pony show of distraction until the political decision is made that it's all right to, talk about this. And they're very slowly moving in that direction.
Okay, well, we'll come on to lots of detail about the second half of this particular viewing project shortly. I just want to throw in a couple of points before we move on. A couple of general ones with regard to the whole idea of seeing that face on Mars in the first place. I mean, yes, those original photographs did look like a face, in the crude resolution in which they were presented. But in general, in this area, when it comes to the unknown and anomalies and the paranormal, there's a high degree of suggestibility, whether it's NASA or whether it's the mainstream media, or even if it's the alternative media. You say to someone, look at this photograph, it's Bigfoot or whatever. And when people are told what they're seeing, quite often as not, they will see what they're being told and not what is there. So that's definitely an issue, I think.
Which is one of the reasons it's so good that remote viewing is done totally blind. And we're very good at picking targets and picking projects within which these targets are based that are very different. They have great variety. Like the project we did right before this was the events of the 9/11 thing, where the Twin Towers in New York and the attack on the Pentagon in 2001. So, and the one we did before that was the Great Pyramid of Giza. And the one we did before that was an anomaly on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean that looked like it was the ruins of an ancient civilization. And the one we did before that was a science experiment on the nature of time. So, that was called our Multiple Universes Project, which was an investigation of ideas that were raised by Hugh Everett in 1957, a physicist who studied under John Wheeler at Princeton. and who came up with the other worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is now the interpretation that's slowly replacing the so-called standard model, or the originally called the Copenhagen interpretation, which is still dominant in physics, but it's clearly stupid and it's being phased out. The younger physicists are accepting the other worlds interpretation finally. And that is, by the way, that is the interpretation that allows for an understanding of remote viewing in the first place. So you see, our projects are very different from one another, and the remote viewers have no idea what's coming at them. And we had never assigned them explicitly extraterrestrial targets, UFO type stuff. We just didn't do that. And for about 15 years, I told them always, don't worry. A lot of them were very hesitant to do extraterrestrial targets because they're hungry for mainstream acceptance. And they thought the combination of extraterrestrial concepts with remote viewing would make it further esoteric. So they wanted always targets that were grounded in something that happened right here on Earth. And so I always said, don't worry, because I didn't want them to quit on me, because these people are not replaceable. So I always said, don't worry, don't worry. I will never assign you extraterrestrial targets. And also the military people were very insistent. They were on our board of directors. They did not want extraterrestrial targets. And then finally what happened is the military people became emeritus members. And they basically retired. They were, you know, getting older, and they retired. And I also don't like rules placed saying I can't do this or can't do that. But all the time during the 15 years that I was promising I'll never do extraterrestrial targets, don't worry, I was lying. And I knew I was going to wait for an opportunity, because they had to do this totally blind. They had to do it totally, totally, totally without any idea that this was going to happen. So there were two projects that I knew I wanted to do, but I knew I couldn't tell the remote viewers that we'd ever do them, because these guys are really so good that if they even suspected that I might do them, they would do the first session, see the basic elements, and then know what the project's about. So I had to keep them blind, because this is going to involve like 6-7 targets that they'd have to go back and back and back at. I had to really make a convincing effort over like 15 years that I'd never do such a thing. So for years I told them that, don't worry, we will never do 9/11. It's clearly the military doesn't want us to touch that stuff. You know, we're not going to do it. Now, I said this on radio. I probably said it on your show. I read it on radio. I said it to them personally and emails and personally. And I also told them, don't worry, we'll never touch extraterrestrial targets. And I said that on radio. And I said it everywhere. And they really bought it hook, line, and sinker. So eventually when I was convinced that they really did believe it, that I'd never do those things, I gave them the 9/11 stuff. And it was really funny to watch them do the sessions, because the sessions for 9/11 came in so great. There was like 7 targets. And you could see them saying, this really does look like the World Trade Center. But Courtney said he'd never do that. What is this? And so they kept in doubt the entire time, which was perfect. That was the only way the sessions could have been done. If they didn't stay in doubt, then the imagination, once they figured out what the real target was, then imagination and memory would have come in, and the project would have had to be stopped. So it really worked. And the same thing with this extraterrestrial stuff. Here I was telling them someplace on Mars, and they were saying in their sessions, Courtney doesn't give us extraterrestrial targets, but the gravity's lighter here and the air is really thin. Daz has a really funny moment for those who, you know, get the humor of this. Where, you know how a dog smells something, like it's driving around on your car and it sticks its nose out the window and it raises its nose up and sort of sniffs, and you can sort of see it like move its nose up and its head up a little bit as it's sensing things. Well, there was a time when Daz and his sessions was noticing that the smell of the place was different and the air was thinner and the gravity was lighter. And then he like raised his head up and you can see him sort of sniffing, sort of smelling like, What is this? It was so funny. And then later on in another session, he says, Courtney doesn't give us any extraterrestrial targets. What is this? The gravity's lighter here. It was so great. You see, they were in doubt. And when their conscious mind is in doubt, these great viewers are scary good because they're taking perceptions directly from what we call their subspace mind, or, you know, what some people in the audience might say, the soul or the spirit or the non-physical element of the real us. And they're taking those perceptions and recording them directly. And it was all captured live on video. And so it's really something that you're on the edge of your seat watching, because you know what the target is supposed to be. And you know that the person that you're watching doesn't know. And you're seeing that person sort of put it all together, and you see all the data come together, and you see all the verifiable stuff, and then the new stuff, the new data, they become extremely persuasive when they're built in to the, when they're mixed with the verifiable data that you know are correct. The air, the gravity, the barren landscape, the hill, the linear elements that are there. I mean, it's like, it becomes very, very credible, very, very believable, very persuasive. And so, yeah, we really knocked it out. We now know what was there in Cydonia, and we know who did it and why they did it and what happened to them.
It was really interesting when Dick and Daz were doing the location as it is now, watching them sketch out. Again, you know, this is, you might be saying, yeah, of course, but for people who haven't seen anything like this before, how similar they're their sketches were, and how they even, you know, went about it in the same way and had the same.
Yeah, it is amazing. By the way, the video of the entire project is available now in video on demand, and you can watch it like immediately. And it will be available in a few days for on as a DVD, also in Amazon, sold through Amazon. The video on demand is sold through Vimeo. But the project, we have a lot of free stuff on our website, but these projects, these video projects, are things that are done totally on video, so they have to be shown on video, and there's only one way we can do that, and that's with professional video presentations that are you know, given in professional venues, such as on DVD or on or video on demand. And there's one thing I would like to say is we are a nonprofit. And we have no way, we do not advertise. So the only way you can find out about our projects and what we're doing is through our newsletter, which is free. And so if I could just give a plug for the newsletter, for people to go to our website and just simply sign up for it. We send out an issue about once a week, and there's no spam. We do not give these email addresses out to anyone for any purpose whatsoever. And so if you go to our website, Farsight, like seeing far, F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T, .org, because we are a nonprofit, at the top of the navigation bar, you'll see sign up for the free newsletter. Just put your email address in there and boom, you're done. And we will notify you, you know, once a week with the new stuff that we're doing.
One little aside about Daz's session, again, when he was looking at the location as it is now, he went off on a little tangent and seemed to be sketching out, he was trying to piece it together in his mind, what looked like, to you and I sat watching it, a group of people being given a presentation.
That was Dick Allgaier, and he was talking about, that's near the end of the video, and he was talking about what's there now, and then, you know, remote viewers, you're raising a really good question, Greg, which is, once a remote viewer is there at a target, they can pick up anything that's relevant to that target. We don't want them just to tell us the verifiable stuff. That we want them to tell us the verifiable stuff. That has to be there so that we know that we're getting good quality data. But then, after we've locked that down, we want them to go off on wherever they find. And in one case, Dick Allgaier noticed that there were people in a scientific setting on Earth that were looking at like PowerPoint presentations at this anomaly and noticing that there was stuff that simply shouldn't be there.
The second half of the session is where Dick and Daz view the location as it was when it was in pristine condition, which as it turns out was a very long time ago. So tell us a little bit about what they discovered.
Well, Greg, this is interesting. The best way for your listeners to understand what was on Mars is to think of us. The Martians looked like us. They were, I like to think of them not as Martians over there, but us when we were there. So they looked like us, they acted like us, they were led by charismatic leaders just by us. What was at Cydonia? It was like a, it was, think of it as a island city. It was surrounded by water, surrounded by an ocean, and it was, had a perimeter around it, and the perimeter, you know, probably, you know, just like walls that you would normally have, surrounding something that was surrounded by water. I mean, you need sort of walls to protect it from waves and other things. And so it was a city that had lots of people on it. And those people had poor areas and they had rich areas. They had rich people. They had poor people. They had people in the middle. They had buildings that were humongous and really, really nice. And they had other areas that would just look like rundown areas in the local area downtown that looks like it was just, you know, where relatively poor people live. You had the whole mix of that. And when Daz and Dick describe what was those people were like and what they were doing, it was really quite clear that they were just like us. Now, also, it was very clear that those people could not perceive us remote viewing them. And that's important to know because humans are like that. Normally, humans cannot perceive when someone is remote viewing them. However, some extraterrestrial types who we do know now, they can perceive us. So if you have remote viewers go to an extraterrestrial ship and you go into it, very often you'll have the extraterrestrials turn right around and stare at the remote viewers. Mind you, they're doing this under totally blind conditions of yours, so they don't know that they've been targeted, that they've been told to go into this ship that's an extraterrestrial ship, until after the sessions are all done and the project's over. But what they report back, you know, that they're in this vehicle of some type and people are turning around and looking straight at them, pointing at them and stuff like that. So some extraterrestrials clearly have the capability of unambiguously noticing when a remote viewer pops in. But these Martians did not. So they're very human in that sense. And these Martians were in this location in a city that would be very much at home on Earth. And what basically happened is they had tunnel systems that were extremely advanced. You know, not that much difference than some of our very advanced subway systems that we have today. So I wouldn't compare it with the subway system in New York. And both Dick and Daz described the underground elements and parts of that Cydonia complex very well. They both described these, you know, passageways going down, the tunnels and so on. Dick gave a long description of the nature of the tunnels, and they weren't like the New York subway system, which sort of run down and dirty with old trains. They were really high tech and really clean, and when they were in their prime, they were really great. Now, this idea of tunnels on Mars has been around a long while, and there's actually good pictures of these tunnels as they surfaced. When erosion processes basically, you know, revealed them. And they have pictures of that, that are available. And we put some of those pictures in the video so people could see some of these tunnels on the surface that have been revealed from erosion processes. But Dick Algar goes into the tunnels and describes them. And then he describes the condition of the tunnels in today, in the current time. And he's really clear about saying, wow, these are much different than the way they were in the past. And he clearly describes and draws really nice pictures of how they were then and how they are today. And he said something like, imagine the New York subway system 10,000 years into the future after the end of civilization, whatever, humanity's gone, and total decay and everything. That's what it looks like now. So that's what the subway system looks like now. It's still there on Mars, but, you know, there are no trains running and it's in total decay and it's collapsing and but it's there. The holes, the tunnels are still existing. You can still walk through them. And that's what it's like now. And it's really interesting to get a good description of that. And it would make sense if Cydonia was a major population center back in those days. It would make sense that the tunnels would, in fact, connect it with other places on Mars. So that's what did happen. And then we, Dick actually in particular covered a little bit more about what happened at the very end. And, we do know what happened. We've had a number of studies dealing with that realm of the solar system. And it was, Dick clearly describes that this thing didn't end with a whimper. It ended with a bang. There was a sudden cataclysmic event that ended up producing like tidal waves, and there was an inundation of the tunnels. That's how Cydonia ended being Cydonia. You know, it was basically washed away. And so we do have lots of information about that. You see, on Mars, if you look at planetary data, one half of Mars is totally covered with huge impact craters. The other half of Mars has nothing. It's flat. So something exploded near Mars that pelted it like a shotgun, and the other half was unscathed. Now, the side of Mars that has craters on it is about a kilometer thicker. The crust is about a kilometer, sometimes up to 3 kilometers, thicker than the other side of Mars. So whatever happened exploded near Mars and pelted it with a lot of stuff and basically laid a lot of debris down. Well, that was the beginning of the end. Now, we did another project, the Farsight Institute, and that's available. You can see it for free right on the website. That project was the origin of the asteroid belt. And what we were doing was we were comparing two hypotheses. One was the mainstream science accepted hypothesis that has absolutely no data to support it. But nonetheless, it's what mainstream scientists tells you at universities, is that it was at the solar nebula hypothesis, which is the asteroid belt is constructed from junk that was left over from the primordial solar nebula. Now, the alternate hypothesis, which was actually, it was the very first reason that was ever given for the origin of the asteroid belt, but it was quickly dropped. But it was heavily supported with a huge amount of planetary data by Thomas Van Flandern, who was a very mainstream astronomer with a huge publication list. And he was the head of the Department of Celestial Mechanics at the Naval Observatory. And he assembled a huge quantity, and I mean huge quantity of data, that supported the understanding that there was a planet there before the asteroid belt, and it exploded for reasons that he said was unknown. So that planet was there, and that's how the asteroid belt actually happened. Now, I don't have time to go into sort of the planetary data, but just to briefly summarize, all the asteroids, they show evidence of extreme heat, about melting and stuff like that. And that wouldn't happen with the solar nebula hypothesis. Also, there's solid rock. They're big rock, like Ceres and so on. I mean, they're like really big rock. And for rock to form, you need a gravity source to compress it. You need a big gravity source to bring all that dust and material in. So you really can't get big asteroids from a solar nebula hypothesis. So anyway, that plus a ton of other data that I'm not going to describe now really support the idea that seems improbable from people who don't want to think about exploding planets. But there was a planet there and it did explode. Now, just to give you an idea of how easy that is for some of you of your listeners that might have an open mind, it's really easy to blow up a planet. It's not hard. You think of it as like, you can't blow up a planet. Stars can blow up because, you know, you get a supernova. You can't blow up a planet. But that's actually not true. That's really Disney. That's really crazy. It's really easy to blow up a planet. Our planet, for example, Earth, is a giant lake. We are an 8,000-mile diameter ball of liquid molten lava. Now, we're just a ball of liquid jelly. I mean, it's really easy. We have an 8-mile thin crust that we live on. So we have a thin crust on top of an 8,000-mile diameter ball of liquid lava. So we can have a planetary disaster that would ruin civilization really easily. All you need to do is pop a hole in the crust and you'll get a blowout. Now, we did another project, the so-called Atlantis Project, where we described that there was an ancient civilization on Earth. It was us, our ancestors. And this is about 70,000 years ago. And they actually did that. They bored into the crust. It was down in the New Zealand area. And they popped a hole in it. And they were doing it on purpose, thinking they could control it. And it just went astray. They couldn't control it. And there was a blowout that was way bigger than any nuclear explosion that you'd ever see. And what you do is you get a dent in the antipode, which is the exact opposite spot of the planet where the blowout happens. And that was in an area that was 1,000 miles west of Morocco and Portugal. And Europe, in fact, used to extend 1,000 miles west of where it is now, and it sunk. And that's where the anomalies under the ocean were that we studied. That's where they did. And we came up with the whole story of what happened with that Atlantis area. And it was science gone astray. But, you know, so you can pop a hole in it really easy. They did it with boring devices. But they were going after the heat that was in the center, thinking they could control it. But, you know, if you wanted to destroy this planet, you know, a very large nuclear weapon buried deep that would knock a big hole in it, that would do it. So in terms of a planet that's out there where the asteroid belt is, there's a variety of different hypotheses about how it could have happened. It could have even been an act of war. That'd be easy to do. If you had a underground bunker deeply buried housing a few hundred, you know, doomsday type nuclear weapons, and you had an enemy that wanted to knock out that bunker and shot a bunker busting bomb into it and blew it up and ignited those things. Those things would blow up the planet. So whatever happened blew up the planet. And it looks like Mars was nearby. Now, there is one theory that Mars may have been a moon of that planet. And whatever happened, Mars was apparently very close to it. And when the thing blew, it was a bad day on Mars. And that was the end of the Cydonia thing. Now, apparently that was not the end of life on Mars. You'd think that a planet exploding nearby would finish off life. But life has a way, just like Jeff Goldblum said in Jurassic Park, life has a way, life finds a way. Societies survived and built itself back. Now, if you look at human society, go back, you know, we often think that we started 3,000 years ago. That's what mainstream science tells you at universities. Well, we now know that that's nuts, but nonetheless, we were pretty primitive 3,000 years ago. But what it looks like now is that we have a society that goes in cycles, that the planet is severely disrupted every 15, 20,000 years or so. Because it is a ball of liquid rock, any burp that the sun gives in our direction is going to shake it a bit, and that will cause tremendous problems on the surface. And that will basically, you know, crumble civilization as we know it. And we have a situation where where our civilization looks like it started like 3,000 years ago, to the point where a lot of people in mainstream science say, yeah, for sure, we started 3,000 years ago. And we built ourselves up to a technologically sophisticated society in less than 3,000 years. I mean, so this is pretty fast. So in Mars, you basically had the same thing. You had the building up of a society in a relatively, you know, whatever length of time, and they rebuilt themselves. Now, it wasn't like the glory days of the past, but they rebuilt themselves. Why do we know this? Because it's very clear and not in dispute among people who have access to the data that there was a thermonuclear explosion on the surface of Mars. We actually know the area it happened, where it happened. We know the antipode for that and the evidence there. But we know it because of nuclear forensics. It's absolutely unambiguous that there's radiation traces on the surface of Mars that could only come from a nuclear bomb, from a nuclear reaction, an explosive nuclear reaction. And, you know, like with nuclear forensics, there's certain things that can only come from certain types of phenomena. And one of those things that they clearly show in the isotope readings on Mars is there was a nuclear detonation. So they know a lot about that. There's a new book out by John Brandenburg, who's a PhD guy, physicist type guy, and he actually has talked about that in a couple books. About it's really for those people who know what, who know about this information and have access to the actual data. It's without doubt that there was a nuclear detonation on Mars. So they built their civilization back, and the nuclear detonation was the final straw that broke the camel's back. The nuclear detonation blew the last elements of the atmosphere off, because Mars is not a really great place in terms of a gravity well. It doesn't really hold on to things very easily. It's a smaller planet. So the bad day that they had with the exploding planet nearby was one thing. Building themselves back was admirable, but the nuclear detonation finished them off. That's when Mars became what we see now, an uninhabitable planet that is, you know, just got a lot of ruins on it. So, and one day we'll see, hopefully it'll be in the near future, we won't have to wait for 100 years or so, that eventually the political decision will be made to let scientists talk about what they know. And it'll be really interesting to see the discussions that are happening on Earth. We actually really need to know about what happened in Mars and the Cydonia region, because we need to learn from the mistakes that the Martians did so that we don't repeat those same mistakes and follow their their path down the the path to hell.
One ironic thing about that might be that if it suddenly was public knowledge that such a civilization existed on another planet, that could actually tip us into our own planetary crisis due to the reaction of it. People have often speculated about how humanity might react if there was ever, you know, confirmation of alien life. One interesting little thought that occurred to me when you were talking about the asteroid belt is that, you know, mainstream science will look at a phenomenon like that and a phenomenon like that, start to formulate possible explanations. And we have a lot of, it's not evidence, but it's hearsay and myths and legends from humanity's past that speaks about, you know, a missing planet, and there's all sorts of names for it, and, you know, the legends are legion, really.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that when science is formulating its own propositions about things like that, that if no matter what any myths and legends might say that might be useful, that you could say, okay, well, that kind of makes sense on one level, or maybe we'll look at this myth and see if there's anything remotely scientific to it. They out of hand will dismiss that, and they will, you know, defend their own postulation, no matter whether it actually holds up or not. So,
yeah,
you know, rather than just say, well, we acknowledge that these tales from the past, there's a lot of distortions there and a lot of misinformation, but actually, we looked at some of this and it ended up pointing us in a direction that was really useful. You know, thanks, but they won't do that.
Yeah, it's a real problem. That's one of the reasons the Farsight Institute exists, where our job right now is to get information out to as many people as possible so that the planetary change can proceed. You see, if you just leave it, first of all, you can't leave this thing to mainstream science, because it's a political decision to reveal these things and to discuss these things. It's not a mainstream science thing. So you have to have somebody bringing out the information, not just about the extraterrestrials, but about the whole issue with remote viewing itself. Because you're talking about, as soon as you're talking about extraterrestrials, the mainstream science people will say, oh, but this is so stupid because extraterrestrials can't get to us anyway. There's not enough rocket fuel and they can't pass the speed of light. So the whole issue of physics has to be addressed. Now, military people, I've been in rooms with like two-star generals on down. You know, they talk about the extraterrestrials like you talk about what you had for lunch. I mean, it's not like, should we have enough evidence to see if they maybe exist? I mean, they just talk about what the guys are doing, what the UFOs are doing and things like that. And then you say, well, look, what if I go out and say, hey, look, I was just talking to so-and-so two-star general. And they were just talking about the extraterrestrials. They know it's real. And they'll look you straight in the face and say, go ahead, do it. I'll just deny it. And you're going to look like a fool. So, you know, they're really covered pretty well. It's a political decision, not a military decision. And it's not a scientific decision on whether or not to talk about this stuff. So really, the military guys they're very interesting. They're very pragmatic. But they're between a rock and a hard place because a lot of them are very altruistic and want to have this stuff come out. But they can't do that because they're government employees and the political decisions have to be made to let that come out. But they know that this stuff has to come out. And so people like us at the Farsight Institute are perfect venues for this information to sort of seep out. And so when I'm here on your show, Greg, it's really something that many people in the upper ups actually approve of. We could be closed down. I mean, we've had the military guys on our board of directors, for God's sake. So we could be closed down a second. I mean, if they wanted to close us down, they would find some reason where we would be out of business the next day. So it's very clear that they want us here and they want us to do it. And this is even the big test for this was the 9/11 project. Once all the remote viewing was in and I told the remote viewers what the data actually were, pointing at, meaning what the targets were and what the project was all about, everybody just looked at one another and everybody said the same thing. Are we going to be allowed to publish this? And I said, I don't think we would have been allowed to get this far if they weren't going to let us publish this. So we published it and there wasn't a single interruption. I mean, we were allowed to do it. And let me emphasize that last sentence. We were allowed to do it. They could have stopped it in a second. So there's a huge element in the military and the military intelligence and in some political circles that want this information out. And they're relying on us to get it out so that the so-called crisis that they're worried about in the future when this stuff becomes public isn't so big. So you get public acceptance. So now remote viewing, we are the leading venue anywhere for these civilian big projects and remote viewing using military or military-derived methodologies. So now it's really big. Everybody knows about us. They know about what we do. Nobody's laughing anymore, Greg. In the early days, say 20 years ago, people were just saying they're deluded. They were laughing. They were mocking. Now, nobody laughs anymore. There's nobody laughing anymore, anywhere. Not in the universities, nothing. It's like a waiting to exhale moment. And they're just waiting for the other foot to fall. So, never bet against smart guys who, and I mean guys generically, men and women, never bet against smart guys who never back down. Absolutely believe in the bottom of your heart, the absolute truth of the matter is that we're doing something that's approved at higher levels and we're being allowed to do it and that eventually this will become clear to other people when they see the eventual acknowledgement from the higher ups that these basic things are real. And it will not be so traumatic for our society because of these efforts that we've done beforehand to sort of lay the groundwork for this so that the population is sort of acclimatized to this type of thing.
One thing in what you just said that prompted a thought with regards to something that's been going on here in the UK in the last couple of years, and this is worldwide, but being here in the UK, I get exposed to the news, and there's been a string of exposés. I know this has absolutely nothing to do with your work, but been a string of exposés and accusations and a number of convictions now of high-profile child abuse cases.
Oh, yeah.
And you might have picked up on this. And I'm wondering, it's not that people haven't been shocked by some of this stuff, but there has been a degree of, we did think this. And I'm wondering about people who 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people on the fringes were saying, look, there's something wrong here. There's something going on and it's big. How much that primed the collective consciousness for revelations that we're seeing now?
Yeah. Things normally don't ideas. Everything is based on ideas, on thoughts. And it is for a group of people as well as individuals. It's impossible for them to make huge leaps in thinking from one thing to the next. It's always a sliding issue. It's always sliding from one set of thoughts to another set of thoughts. So it was always a graduated process. And so when you had these child abuse things, you had knowledge of this stuff happening before, but the open recognition took a while for people to be able to talk about it, meaning it was just not so easy or not so physically, sort of physically possible to talk about this stuff early on. Now, you can assume that child abuse is not limited to stuff that was being revealed in the UK. You can assume that it's equally a problem in, you know, Saudi Arabia, United States, Ukraine, Russia, China. I mean, you can assume it's a human problem, not just a UK issue. I mean, remember all of the child abuse stuff that happened here in the United States, relevant just a few years back with the Catholic Church, where it turned out to be that the Catholic Church had the biggest ring of pedophiles that existed, and they were called priests.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a big issue, and this had been known for a long time in many circles, but people were not able to sort of talk about it. Well, you're bringing up this issue is sort of interesting. That's sort of what we're in, the problem we're in with regard to both acknowledging remote viewing and that exists, that it's a real thing, and the consequences in our way of thinking, but also extraterrestrial life. People know about it, but having the ability to make that leap to talk about it openly is a completely, completely different type of thing. So, you know, there are limitations in our thinking, and those limitations are a consequence of the rigidity of thought, how much we've practiced a certain type of thought. Now, let's go back to the pedophile thing. What do you really want to have when you have a society that's as evolved as Great Britain? You want to have a belief that things are organized, that are orderly, that there's a parliament, that you have a prime minister, that there's a queen, that there's, you know, you survived World War II. I mean, it's, you want to believe that things are okay. And you don't want to believe or know that sort of everything sort of has an underbelly that's got real deep corruption in it. So in order to talk about the problems that you have to sort of acknowledge that the intellectual infrastructure of organization that is designed to help people and be comforting to people has got some very serious fundamental flaws in it. And so sort of acknowledging that that's what you believe in is not what the reality is, that's a real intellectual pattern that is hard to break. Whenever you believe a thought long enough, well, actually, what is a belief? Whenever you think a thought long enough, it becomes a belief. So when you're talking about acknowledging the problems like the pedophilia problems, you're talking about a practiced thought about the niceness of society that you've practiced so long that it's become a belief, that that's not true. So the problem is that the practiced thought is practiced. It's a habit. It's really hard to break habits. That's why it's so hard for these new thoughts that things aren't as good as they should be to actually break in. Now, with regard to remote viewing and extraterrestrial life, there is a practiced thought that actually is in some way related to the pedophilia issue, which is that we are an organized society where that type of thing doesn't happen. We have laws that prevent that type of thing. We have law enforcement. Everything is orderly. And also we have a practice thought that we are the center of the universe, that God created us and there is no other life but us in the entire universe. And we are it and we are the center. We are made in God's image. That thought, as crazy as it is a practice thought. And it's been repeated over and over and over again. So it's really difficult to break out of a practice thought. It becomes like concrete. And to accept something that's very different from that, that the life is everywhere throughout the universe and that you know, that extraterrestrial life can travel here and has been here. And so these practice thoughts are the real challenges that we really face in society. And that's why it's so hard to bring these new ideas up to people. If you take a practice thought, which is solidified like concrete in the minds of the masses, and disrupt it, imagine going to a building that you're trying to take down so you can build a new building, and it's made of concrete. Imagine going there with a sledgehammer. It's really hard. You got to really break it up. I mean, you got to smash it. And that's what their thought, that's what the fear is, that the practice thought is so deeply entrenched that to break it up quickly would require a lot of violent energy. And then you just get a crumbled building as a result. So it's easier to soften up the building rather than to try to crash it when it's hard. So to soften up the building, you have to put like, well, let's make the analogy a little bit bigger or the metaphor a little bit bigger. You have to put like softeners in there. you have to sort of cover it with some liquids that'll seep into the cracks and make it. So the basic idea of softening up a building is to put new ideas in there and let these new ideas filter through the society so that the practice thought isn't so heavily practiced anymore. And that's what we do. That's where our role is at the Farsight Institute. We are introducing these ideas into the mainstream, and everybody who gets one of our videos, everyone who buys a video and watches it and then talks about it with their friend, is actually helping the transformation of all of society, because you're introducing new ideas that are loosening up the solidified hard stuff from before and allowing for the transformation to occur. So the pedophilia thing came to a head in Britain, not because somebody took a sledgehammer to it, but because it was probably helped a great deal by the pedophilia expose that occurred with regard to the Catholic Church. And so that sort of let those ideas in, and then people started to talk about the other problems. And if it could happen in a Catholic Church in America, well, it could happen in UK, and then those ideas sort of came through, and then you have sort of, so it's the sliding of ideas, not the sudden change of ideas, that really makes things happen. You know, ultimately, when you deal with this pedophilia idea, you're dealing with something that goes back to Victorian era, which is the prohibition of sexual and sensual thought, producing all types of distortions. And then when you have a repressed level of sexuality, that sexuality comes out in other ways that are very distorted, and then you get pedophilia and other things. So you really wonder what's happening in Saudi Arabia, for example, or Islamic countries where sensuality is so severely repressed, way more than happened with Victorian elements in our society. And so you can just assume that what's happening in Saudi Arabia is way bigger of a problem than what you have in Britain. And that, what are you doing in Britain about it? You're actually helping by having the priest scandal in the Catholic Church that helped to sort of open things up and allow Britain to face its own problems with that. And by having Britain face its own problems, believe it or not, that will eventually spill over. And eventually, at some point in time, we'll have revelations about what's going on in places like Saudi Arabia and others. So when we have these problems and these revelations that come out, believe it or not, it's a domino type of a theory that whatever healing takes place on one spot on the planet ends up indirectly helping other places on the planet that are having problems that are as bad or worse.
That concludes part one of our interview. Be sure to tune in next week for part two. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is legalizefreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were 7 UK pounds, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.